The old adage of water, water everywhere, not a drop to drink, is pretty true when it comes to the surface of the earth. The surface of the earth, 70% of the surface of the earth is covered by oceans, but if we look at how much water there is distributed in the earth, we have over 97% of it is in the oceans, and that's too salty to drink. And so we're dealing with a very small remaining amount, which is then fresh water in the earth. And you can see that most of that fresh water, in fact, is tied up in our ice caps and glaciers. Some is in groundwater, and then some is in surface water and lakes and soil moisture and rivers and so on. And both the groundwater and the surface water are waters that can be tapped to use for human consumption. The ice caps and the glaciers, I'm sure many of you have heard all the proposals in recent years to try and tap those, and that may be an idea for the future, but it isn't one that we have available to us right now. When we live in the Northwest, those of us who do, we're reminded as to where water, where our surface and groundwater comes from, out of the sky. But there's a whole cycle involved. The water is evaporated from surface bodies of water, from the oceans, from rivers, from lakes, and in part from soil moisture. It then is up in the atmosphere in the form of a gas. We see it often in clouds, and then through precipitation it comes back to the surface. The question is, what happens to it when it comes back to the surface? Well, over 65% of what comes back to the surface evaporates again, so that is not even incorporated into bodies of water that can be useful to us, either in groundwater or rivers or lakes. And so one of the things that I was going to talk about today is both some issues of excess water and primarily some issues of deficient water, and then to move on to what we personally can do in our lives and to affect society to consume less water. And I always at that point sort of like to open it up to what ideas people have, because while I have a set of them, people have very creative things that they do to conserve water themselves. The daily water usage in the United States is somewhere in the order of 1.5 trillion liters. Now, a liter is close to a quart. It's not precisely a quart. You all know what a liter is by a pop bottle. 1.5 trillion liters of water a day. About 3/4 of that comes from surface water, and the remaining amount from groundwater. What do we use the water for? What do we, as individual consumers, use it for? And then, actually, what is the per capita consumption? I think is always kind of interesting to look at. In terms of daily usage, these are sort of estimates, and I've given you some equivalents in gallons, because I think in the U.S. we think more in terms of gallons. Some of this has all been made clear to us by the little notes that are around in our bathrooms that remind us of some of these things. But if we just look upon daily usage on a per-person kind of consumption, I mean, we have cooking, which is involved. This number of 8 liters is much higher than in the lesser developed countries in terms of how much water they're using for cooking. Every time we flush the toilet, as Holden has reminded us, this uses a lot of water. Do you all know why this was so much an issue here this summer, Holden?
The drain fields. Septic.
Yes, it backed up in June. There was a weekend in June where there were 2 outhouses available for the entire population. What they then discovered was, because, in part because Holden is maintained by a volunteer staff, it's hard to necessarily keep track of things from year to year. And what it turned out was that the holding tank system for the septic system hadn't been pumped in 5 years. And so it had taken more of a strain than it was supposed to. Baths versus showers. There seems to be some trade-off. If you take a short shower, then it uses less water, but if you take a long shower, you're going to use more. Many of the shower heads here, I gather, have low flow reducers on them, although the one in where I'm staying certainly does not.
We'll
try it again. Our does.
Is it one designed for that, do you think, or is it one which is just
trickling?
Yeah, clogged up. Because good low flow showers, you would never know that they're low flow. I mean, once they have enough air being forced through them so that the force of the water feel like a regular shower.
Well, why don't you go and try out today?
All right, I'll check with you later.
Actually, they also have something where you can turn the water off.
Yes.
And then back on, still keep the same temperature.
Yep, that's right.
Just on this, and we'll come back and talk about some of those things. You can see that watering the lawn uses a lot more water than a shower does, a load of laundry, and so on. Well, this is what we all think of in terms of our own daily usage, but in fact, there's a lot of other indirect types of use that affect us on a day-to-day basis. Sunday newspaper, isn't that kind of an appalling amount that one copy of the Sunday newspaper has required that much water to get to that stage? To make the steel for a washing machine, to refine a ton of petroleum, to make one automobile, in order to cool the system in a power plant, and then to produce enough food for one day for a family of four. So that in fact, when we take and add in what we are aware of in terms of our own consumption, and all the other kinds of things that we use in our lives, which have had to be produced, then we end up with some per capita usage in the United States of about 5,700 liters. And then just some other numbers to compare that to other countries, Canada, Soviet Union, China, and India. And you can see that, as usual, we're at the top of the heap and such things. Basically, when water usage in the United States is talked about, nearly half of it on an annual basis goes toward agriculture, and very close to, 47% to agriculture and 44% to industrial use. And 80% of that, unfortunately, is for cooling of power plants. And then the remaining 9% goes to urban and residential use. So we think of ourselves as perhaps doing well in terms of conservation, but in fact where we may need to be thinking about conservation is in terms of the much larger consumers that we are using in an indirect kind of fashion.
Is it actually consumed in a power plant?
Well, it had to cool the heat source. And
are you talking about nuclear?
No, all kinds of power plants.
So even hydroelectric?
No, but oil burning and coal burning, which dominate in the United States. Hydroelectric supplies, I can't remember what the statistic was, it's something like only 8% of all the U.S. power is hydro.
But the residual, does that return to the rivers? Or
for which?
For the power plants.
For the most part it does, but anybody know what happens to it?
It's warm.
That's right. Yeah. So that it isn't the same kind of water. But for the most part, that's right, it is able to be returned to where it came from.
And it doesn't mean another city downstream could use that.
That's right, that's right. And actually, the next thing I wanted to talk about was sort of how does the water get to us? How many people here live in the Northwest on the west side of the Cascades? Okay, where does our water come from?
Mountains.
That's right, the rain falls, the water's collected, and it either is collected from surface catchments or from the groundwater and then brought to us. And basically what we have in that area is what we call single use of water. The rain falls and the water is brought to us and we use it. And then where does it go?
Back
out into the ocean. It's Puget Sound for the most part if we live in the Tacoma, Seattle area. But that is not true of most of the United States. Most of the water in the United States actually goes through what we call multiple use. And that means that it may have gone through a reservoir and then be purified and returned. Or it may be taken out of a river, be purified, used, and then the waste put into the river. And then the next community takes it out of the river, purifies it for their use, treats the waste, puts it back in the river, and so on. How many times do you suppose that's happened by the time it gets to New Orleans? Huh? Well, the number I heard is 26 times.
You mean that a single molecule of water would actually have been...
Well, if we were to look at it on an average basis, that's right. That the water, by the time it reaches New Orleans, has been cycled 26 times as it travels down through the river system.
But there's
26
potential places for the river.
No.
More than that.
Yeah, right.
I believe that there are 26 sites along the Mississippi River.
No, a lot more than 26 sites.
And of course, it's not just the Mississippi, but the whole network that feeds into the Mississippi. So, we have this branching system. But But anyhow, it makes you realize that you're kind of lucky when you live in the Northwest, that the water hasn't been through this whole process before. Now, as I said earlier on, there are really two issues to deal with when we think about water. One is this issue of quality, and the other is the issue of quantity. And some of you may have said in other sessions this week that are dealing with issues of water quality, all of which are fascinating, and we're just sort of going to leave those out because that's not part of the story that I'm working with today. In terms of quantity, we have too little, which I think is what most of us think of, but there are also places where there's too much water. And some of that is through human activity, and some of that is the result of simply the natural processes on the surface of the earth. And then the other issue associated with quantity is the cost. In the Northwest, we tend not to worry about it very much. Water isn't really expensive. It falls out of the sky most of the year, and so it isn't an issue for us. However, many times in the Northwest, there is the issue of too much water. And flooding is one which, certainly in the last couple of years, has become a very important issue in the Puget Sound region. We've had a lot of flooding, particularly in urban areas, and it makes us think about what kinds of human impact are having, what types of impact there are on the water systems, the natural systems, versus the developed areas. In the natural system, rain falls. It either hits trees or it hits ground. Much of it is either used directly by the plants or it evaporates off the plants. And then that which falls to the ground either percolates into the water, down through the surface, into what we call the water table, which we'll talk about a little later, or it evaporates as well. So, or some of it, if it doesn't soak into the ground, may run off into stream systems, which then flow into larger systems of rivers and so on. And that's the very natural process. Now, what happens when we look at an urban area? Well, we've covered over the ground. So the water can no longer percolate into the ground and ultimately into the groundwater reservoir. And these past couple of years, we have had floods that have been described in the Seattle-Tacoma area as being the 100-year floods. Well, if you have 100-year floods every 5 years, something's out of whack. And either the climate system is changing, or we are doing something through human activity to increase the risk of flooding. And that seems to be the general consensus, is that we have paved enough of the urban areas that we no longer have the water doing the natural thing, which is to percolate into the ground. Instead, it's running off. It's having to flow into whatever sort of catchment system there is, into drains, into creeks, and so on. But it is that increase the volume which is flowing in those creeks to the level that we describe as the 100-year flood. Now, the 100-year flood is an average kind of thing. It means that the rivers may rise to such a height on every 10-year average, or they may rise to an even greater height on an every 100-year average. But if we have 200-year floods in 5 years, then the chances are it's very much the result of having paved over the ground. And so it's one thing that we all have to think about, I think, in terms of what we can do, not directly, but perhaps indirectly in terms of legislation, to encourage areas to still retain exposed ground and vegetation to allow a lot of that water to be able to percolate down into the ground. Now, there are other countries where too much water happens every year. The monsoon flooding in the northern part of the Indian Ocean, in Bangladesh and India and so on, is something which is simply part of the natural cycle in that area. That is how the climate system works there. It's very dry half the year and it's very wet half the year. And that region has developed in terms of the topography and the vegetation there in response to this flooding system. It simply falls too fast to be able to soak in. But that isn't something that we can necessarily deal with. I think we need to be able to think about dealing with it in our urban areas here in a more direct fashion. Now, I don't know if other people have other comments to say about the too much water. I have one sort of little anecdote, and then I thought I'd move on to too little water, unless I had questions. I live in the community of Puyallup, and there's a small creek where there are homes. Some of them date from probably the 20s and 30s, built close to the bank of the creek. And I have one very callous attitude, which is if you live on the bank of a creek, you have to expect that periodically you're going to have problems. But on the other hand, those houses have been there for decades, and the past couple winters, they've been subjected to very serious flooding where some of their basements have filled all the way up. Well, if you look along that stream bed itself, there doesn't appear to be any problem. There are all sorts of issues raised of, well, the vegetation's grown up and that should be causing the flooding. Well, the vegetation really isn't going to cause the flooding very much. Vegetation will help in some ways to keep the surface soil in the bottom of the creeks loose enough to allow the water to percolate down. But this creek flows, how many people here know Puyallup? The old part of Puyallup is down in a valley, and all the new development in Puyallup is taking place up in an area called South Hill. And this creek flows basically off the bank, the hillsides, where from South Hill and then down through the valley of the low area. Well, probably the flooding in this creek is a result of all the paving which has taken place up on South Hill, where the water should be naturally soaking in, but instead that whole area is simply covered over with development, and so the water has nowhere to go in its natural sense, and instead it's flooding down and into this valley of this small creek. And this is an example of where the effects are not necessarily in the same location as where the development is going on. But boy, those residents want something done about it right now. And in many ways, I don't blame them. Unfortunately, you're never going to get many square miles of pavement removed. But anyhow, I thought I'd move on to start talking about too little water, starting on sort of small scale kinds of things and then looking at some bigger situations. We have something which we call the water table. And that simply refers to the surface of where groundwater is. Basically, when we have ground surface, the water percolates down through the sediments, down to some level. And when we drill a well, you drill a well to the point where it's down below this level of the water table to where there is groundwater between all the particles of the sediments. And so if you then pump, or even through some natural system, if there's pressure on this groundwater, you'll have it flowing up in an artesian system. And this figure then illustrates one of the particular problems associated with using groundwater. Most of the time we're in fact pumping water out because it's not pressurized to come up to the surface itself. And so if we pump extensively because of heavy water usage, then we're actually drawing the level of the groundwater down. We're using all the water which was up here in these particles, and our well has to penetrate deeper and deeper and deeper down to the area below the water table so that we're actually getting water out of our well. And one of the things that happens in the case of a very heavily pumped well is that adjacent wells, which originally may have been penetrating down below the water table into this reserve in the groundwater, no longer reach down below the water table because we pump so heavily that we create what we call a cone of depression. And this is very common. Some of our ancestors a couple of generations ago may have drilled wells, may have had very successful water coming out of there for years and years, and then as the community gets more developed, they find that their wells run dry. And this is precisely the kind of thing that happens. So what do you have to do if you're the neighbor? Well, then you too put in a deeper well, and you pump out of it, and you simply increase the size of the cone of depression. Well, when this is occurring in an area in the interior, far from the sea, all you do is drill a deeper well and that solves your problem, although it may cost you money. But in the case of wells which have been drilled near the coastal region, originally they had some lens of fresh water. This is then the surface of the land, this is sea level, and there's some lens of fresh water, and because salt water is more dense, when you're near the coast, you usually have a layer of salt water beneath the less dense layer of fresh water above. And what they're showing here is what happens as wells continue to get pumped, that originally this well here, which was pumping the surface water table, was here, and then the bottom level of the water table was down here, with salt water out here and an entire lens of fresh water. And then as pumping continues, not only does the coastal well end up having salt water coming into it, but as you pump and pump to remove the water from here, you'll ultimately be pulling salt water in beneath this aquifer, this lens of water here, and you have what's called salt water intrusion. And in the Puget Sound region, this has started to happen to some of the coastal areas. Vashon Island in particular basically has this lens of fresh water sitting on the surface of salt water, and the communities there have grown enough to where their wells are now ending up pumping up salt water rather than fresh water.
What are they going to do?
Obviously, for a while, you can operate with a somewhat shallower well, because then you end up still within the aquifer. But hopefully what they're going to do is think about the problem and not strain the aquifer so much, so that the natural size of this freshwater lens can grow again. But
how deep are they?
I don't know the numbers for that on Vashon Island. But I mean, that's an education problem, and that's part of what we'll come back and talk a little bit about. Now, some of the other things that happen is that we simply deplete the aquifer in order to have what this lens of water that we refer to as an aquifer. We have to allow it to replenish itself naturally. And when we're near the coastal region, obviously you have the problem of salt water. When we're in the interior of the continent, we simply deal with the fact that the water table level keeps diminishing as there's less and less water available. And this map of the U.S. then shows in shading regions where there has been an excessive overdraft of the groundwater system and down to regions where it is not a particular problem. You can see that this area here in the Midwest is one which has been very susceptible. Since the largest aquifer in the United States, it's called the Ogallala Aquifer, basically goes from Texas and Oklahoma and New Mexico up through Nebraska and Colorado. Kansas and Nebraska and Colorado. And this has been extensively used for crops, for cotton, for corn, for wheat, also to supply water on grazing lands, for cattle. And one of this region of the country is one where the rainfall is not as high as it is in some of the coastal regions, and so the rate at which an aquifer gets replenished is fairly slow. There are somewhere in the order of 150,000 wells which extract water out of this aquifer, and it is now dropping on the order of somewhere between, my two sources are in disagreement as to quite what the magnitude is, but somewhere on the order of perhaps 2 to 5 feet per year. So that means that if you have a well which is drilled down into this aquifer, on some frequency, you can end up having your well run dry and have to extend it deeper and deeper and deeper. And this is an issue here where the use of the water occurs at such a fast rate that it simply hasn't the ability to recharge naturally. The water, which is used for irrigation, can percolate back down in, but of course when you bring it to the surface, it's that much more susceptible to evaporation. So less of it is returning back down into the aquifer on a natural basis.
Why is it good? Irrigation create a lot of salt.
Because water naturally has dissolved minerals in it. Waters flow over rocks and they dissolve on a very slow time scale the rocks that they flow over. They leach things out of the soils naturally. And what happens is if you take any water and bring it to the surface and let it evaporate, other than pure distilled water, you will have some small residual amount of what was once originally dissolved material. And if you do that time and time again at the surface, bringing water up for irrigation, so much of it evaporates that you have this buildup of what was once a very small concentration of salt. But if the process goes on for long enough, then you're still stuck with a much larger buildup. And some waters are saltier than others. I mean, we think of the seawater as being very salty, but even in terms of the term salinity, which refers simply to the amount of dissolved material, we have differences in the salinity of what we think of as fresh water, too. Accompanying this problem of overdraft of the aquifers is also the fact that we have, and we talked about this before, the saltwater intrusion. We can see this is a problem all along in coastal communities, but we also have subsidence of the land. The water, which was there between the particles of the sediments in the ground, once that water is extracted, it's no longer supporting those particles, and they now end up in contact with each other, and basically the land subsides through time. This has been a big problem in certain areas. The San Joaquin Valley, which is also a region where they're simply depleting the aquifer through here, is a region of enormous subsidence. Basically, since the 1850s, since settlement grew in a big way in the middle in California, they have been growing crops and irrigating and drawing the water out of the aquifer. And groundwater levels themselves have fallen some places as much as 120 meters. So looking at about 375 feet or so, where the aquifer, the surface of the aquifer has subsided just because of overdraft. But accompanying that, there are areas where the land has subsided as much as 9 meters, so close to 30 feet. And there are some, there are pictures of signs, you know, railroad crossing signs or whatever, which are on concrete posts, and you can see that the land has just subsided around them. Somewhere on the, in some regions, somewhere on the order of 30 centimeters a year, something close to a foot of subsidence of the land each year.
Is that also the cause of the sinkholes in some areas?
Well, the sinkholes, actually I was going to talk about the sinkholes. The sinkholes are in a different type of rock. And much of the problem with sinkholes occurs down here because the rock type there is limestone. And the limestone dissolves quite easily as water flows through it. And so what you have beneath the state of Florida is this whole network of sort of tunnels and caves through the limestone. But when the water occupies those tunnels and caves, it gives support to the overlying rock in the same kind of way. But when you take out the water from those tunnels and caves, then you're not just having gradual subsidence, but you end up having this huge void beneath the surface, and then the mass of the material above it simply makes it collapse. So it's a similar kind of thing, but because the rock type is different, the effects are much more dramatic. In this area, basically the San Joaquin Valley is filled with sediment, clay and silt and sand kind of thing. So it happens in a more gradual kind of sense. Mexico City, which is built on an old lake bed, has that region has probably been inhabited since the Aztecs have lived there. They have probably been experiencing subsidence since the Aztec time. However, it looks like the subsidence, again, of close to 9 meters, sort of in historic time there, or recorded time, simply by looking, by keeping track of records. In coastal cities, there can be a problem from subsidence, both from the extraction of water, but also from the extraction of oil. And Long Beach, California is an area where they had, again, about 30 feet of subsidence because they extracted oil. And the oil, which was beneath that community, had given the same kind of support to the overlying sediments. And when that was removed, then the whole region subsided. Now there, they weren't depending on a water source from in the ground, since there isn't a lot of water in the ground in that area anyhow. So what they did was simply pump seawater back in to sort of restore the surface there. But lots and lots of big cities and coastal regions have problems. New Orleans has lots of problems in that respect, Houston, and in other countries, Tokyo and so on. A similar kind of problem. Let's see. Now, we have a lot of impact not only on groundwater, but also on surface water. And in the Northwest, we aren't depending so much upon groundwater, so we can sort of think of ourselves as exempt from a lot of these problems of overdraft of the aquifers. Instead, much of our water is trapped from surface water runoff and then is used by communities. And how do we trap much of that? Well, we build a dam so that we have some reservoir behind it, and then we can take our water from that reservoir. Well, dams themselves are in no way immune to environmental impact. And certainly, we think of that in terms of fish. I mean, fish naturally migrate up our rivers, and if we build a dam, they can't migrate, so we have to do things like build fish ladders to help them go up. But the environmental impacts of building dams are much, much greater than that. One of the things is that we're now creating a very large standing body of water, and the surface of that water is going to evaporate. And Lake Powell, 6 yards of water a year evaporate from the surface of that lake. It's a very large lake in an arid region, and the water just sits there, and so it can easily evaporate. If we then have a lot of evaporation, then the dissolved material which is in that water becomes more concentrated in the water that remains, and so we increase what we call the salinity. And as I said, it isn't salinity in the sense that we think of for ocean water, but we still increase the concentration of the dissolved material in any given volume. Well, we build a dam to trap water, but what else do we trap behind the dam? A lot of sediments. And that has two negative impacts. Obviously, we're going to fill up the reservoir with sediments, which then decreases the volume of our reservoir. But where do those sediments go if they naturally are allowed to flow down the river? To the beach, says a man who's lived in Southern California. California doesn't have a lot of water, so they trap all the water they can. So basically, every river in Southern California has a dam on it, so the water can be trapped. California, Southern California used to be noted for wonderfully wide beaches. Well, there's a natural process where along this coastline, there's a migration of sand in the beaches towards the south. That's just part of the oceanographic circulation that takes place here. It was never a problem because the rivers were always bringing the sediments down to replenish them as they were transported southward. Well, now there are dams built on the rivers. All the sediments are being trapped. There is not the supply of sediments coming out to the beaches. And what's happening to the beaches in Southern California? They're simply retreating. They're getting narrower and narrower because this natural erosion is still taking away the sediments, transporting them further south. There are a lot of problems with simply building a dam in a high-risk area, in that we may be trapping the water there in order to use it for some purpose like water, drinking water or irrigation, but sometimes it's also being trapped to diminish the risk of flooding downstream. And yet, any kind of a disaster, an earthquake is a simple example, you then increase the risk of flooding downstream if you have this huge trapped body of water. And that is a big risk. There was a dam in Italy, and I can't remember what decade it was. It was in the 50s or 60s. There was a massive landslide that wiped out the dam, and there was massive flooding downstream. And everybody thought of themselves as being immune to that. This dam gave them this wonderful protection upstream. As we diminish the flow of sediments downstream, it can have all sorts of ecological impacts as well to human kinds of ecologies. The Nile River is a very good example. The Aswan Dam was built in the 1960s for two reasons. One, for flood control, because they were tired of having major floods on an annual basis downstream, and two, because they wanted to be able to generate electricity. Well, accompanying these, the waters that came and flooded the lower reaches of the Nile, were the sediments that were being transported with them. And what is happening in the Nile region is that that entire delta is eroding because there isn't the supply of sediments, and the fertility of the lower plains have dropped very low. And that's because there isn't this constant replenishment of the nutrients to the ground that come along with the sediments. So, dams are great things. They produce lots of electricity for us, but there's a lot of other things that we can think of in terms of how necessary dams are and what we need to keep in mind. Again, if we're going to transport water over long distances through canals and through aqueducts and things like that, we start to have a lot of similar kinds of impacts. Obviously, we can have a lot of evaporation of the water as it's transported and the increased salinity as well. But we're often, because we're transporting water to some other region where we think there's a greater need for it, we're having a very severe impact on the water at the source that it came from. And I'm going to show just a few slides of Mono Lake because that's a real classic example. But in the Soviet Union, the Aral Sea, which I believe used to be the largest inland body of water in the world, has decreased dramatically in volume and area over the last few decades even. You can see that this is the size out here that the lake was, so this inland sea was in 1960, and most of this water is being withdrawn to be used for irrigation purposes. It may be being withdrawn in the rivers that are bringing it into this basin, but the impact then on this sea is very dramatic. And there are estimates that it may simply just dry up because so much of this water is being used. It's basically shrunk by 2/3 in the last 30 years or so.
Is this saltwater running or?
No, it's freshwater. Although,
What's left is...
It becomes increasingly saline, that's right. Who knows where Mono Lake is? Everybody probably wants to say Mono Lake, but in fact, if you talk to the locals, they would be offended. It's pronounced Mono Lake. That's right, it's on the east side of the Sierras. It's almost due east of where Yosemite National Park is. But it's down in the valley that's on the east side. And it is a region where there is not a lot of rainfall, although there's a fair amount of water which collects in the basin, primarily from runoff and melt from the snow at the high elevations in the winter months. Now, for years, starting in the 1950s, they have been taking water from that side of the mountain and transporting it over to the east side of the mountain, and most, for the most part, down into the Los Angeles area as for the source of water. Now, Los Angeles sits down here. Oops, I'm going to appear up there automatically. Los Angeles sits down here in a region which is very dry. This entire coastline of Southern California is very dry. We're basically in a latitude, which if we go further east, is a latitude that is in large part a desert. And the same thing is true here along the west coast of California as well. It's a desert, so they need to bring in whatever water supply they can. Do you know how to turn on such a projector?
Try.
Okay, right on the back, on the other side, actually, in the back, there's a switch which moves up and down, has like four positions. If you just move it all the way to the top, that would be great. This is a picture taken of Mono Lake, actually taken about a year ago in April. Looking for the most part from the northeast over the lake. Now, this lake was described in the 1850s prior to much settlement in California. And at that time, it was described as being a very briny lake. It was not pure fresh water, because basically what we have is a trapped basin, and so we have natural evaporation which is taking place here anyhow, and the water is saline because the salts are being concentrated in it. But what has happened over the last few decades is that the water which naturally flows into this basin and sort of replenishes it to maintain this level of salinity are being drawn to be taken elsewhere, and so the lake is shrinking in size and the salinity is changing. Now, it has always supported kind of an interesting community of organisms. There are brine flies that live there in great abundance. And then there are birds that feed on the brine flies, and that's sort of what the community is that exists there. But since the Los Angeles started withdrawing water from the flown into this basin, the lake levels have dropped 12 meters, so we're looking at something 35 to 40 feet. And the level in the lake itself has then shrunk in size. Now, because it's a sort of saline area, there are this deposition of an interesting kind of rock. It's called tufa. It's a calcium carbonate rock. It's never quite clear why this rock grows the way it does, but it grows underwater. Generally, it's believed that there may be some springs which come up out of the ground into the lake, and they carry some minerals with them, which then become concentrated. Probably there's some mat of algae or something that live on the surface that help to concentrate the calcium and the carbonate to make this limestone-like rock. But you can see by looking at this picture alone that all of this formed underwater. That's where tufa forms, and you can see it exposed here. I visited Mono Lake twice in the last decade. The first time I visited was in 1981, and I took this picture. And what I'm going to show you is a picture which sort of by accident I took, which I think goes from here on over, so that we're not seeing the exact same view across the lake, but it will show just how much it actually changed in a decade or so, and that you can see that I think we were looking at perhaps the upper part of this as we looked across in this other region. And I was struck by just walking around down in the area that's sort of a local park, how far out it was to the lake shore compared to when I'd been there before. I mean, we'd driven down to one area and we walked right to the lake, and now you have to drive down and walk a great distance down to the lake. The people in Mono County, where the lake is located, are trying desperately to reclaim their water rights, but it's been going on for a very long time.
They want.
Did they finally win?
Yeah.
But will they get it all?
The judges said yes, but we'll see.
Yeah. That's right. That's the problem. Now, the last kind of example that I want to talk about is the Colorado River, and you can either turn it off or just leave it.
Part of that decrease is also that there's been a drought.
Yes, but that drought has occurred sort of on and off, but in the last 3 years it's been extensive. But we're talking about lake levels that have changed 40 feet over 40 years. So that's an ongoing problem, and that's not just...
It goes back beyond this recent...
Oh, yeah, good, because it was in the 50s that they first started diverting the water.
We went to Lake Tahoe this summer,
and
its
you could
lake
see it
level
there.
Has
yeah,
gone down.
You could see it.
Oh, an 8 feet.
8 feet.
I bet you could see it.
Yeah, that's a huge...
It's dropped below the exit of the Truckee River, so they actually
wow.
have to pump water out of Lake Tahoe into the Truckee River.
And why do they want to keep water flowing in the Truckee River?
It's a water source for Reno.
Well, then that's a good reason to stop. No.
But what about the case of Salt Lake?
The Great Salt Lake?
Yeah, 20 years ago, that lake was way down, but now it's...
comes back
up.
Now the Great Salt Lake is what's left of a lake that once occupied about four states at the end of the last glaciation. And so the Great Salt Lake is another example of this increase in salinity because of the concentration of water, but by a very natural process. And I mean, the fluctuations there over whatever you're saying this 12 years are the result, I think, in part of human activity, but also in part of natural kinds of fluctuations. And that's what they're seeing in Lake Tahoe. I mean, we get these fluctuations in the amount of rainfall. We can't count on it being the same from year to year. We have droughts. It's just that human activity is either demanding the water when it's not there, or is accentuating some of the problems.
But nature is...
Nature does it too, that's right. I mean, the problem with Mono Lake, I'm sure it changed on some sort of a fluctuation due to just the natural cycles. But the problem here is that there's just this steady documentation of the lake level dropping because all the water's being diverted. The last case that I want to talk about is that of the Colorado River. The Colorado River's made a lot of press in the last year. There's a lot going on in terms of legislation to try and adjust long-standing agreements to usage of the Colorado River. But basically, in the Colorado River flows through seven different states, and so there was an agreement set up by the Colorado River Compact in 1922, dividing the river into two basins, the upper basins where the river sort of originates and the lower basin where the river flows through it. You can see that there are 10 major dams built on the river and 30 or more built on the river, smaller ones on the river and the tributary. And the agreement was in 1922 to allocate 7.5 million acre feet of water to the upper basin and 7.5 million acre feet of water to the lower basin. An acre foot measurement, I can't remember the conversion to gallons, but basically it's the amount of water it would take to flood an acre of land 1 foot deep with water in terms of volume. And then in 1944, Mexico said, hey, wait a minute, you know, the river is supposed to actually flow down through Mexico before it exits into the Gulf of California, and so we want our share, and so they were allocated a whopping 1.5 million acre feet. So the total amount which through legislation is allocated to these three different regions is 16.5 million acre feet. Well, you can see that the average production of the river does not even reach 15 million acre feet. So that already they were allocating more than was there, and then on top of that, this year, because of the drought, it's dropped down very dramatically. Does anybody know what the river looks like by the time it reaches Mexico?
They're not getting their 1.5 million acre feet.
It isn't. There is no water which flows into the Gulf of California. No water.
Wow.
That's right. A lot of the same problems are true on the Colorado River. Some of the things that I mentioned before when talking about dams, a lot of siltation going on, and then you end up with erosion downstream, all sorts of problems that are impacting just the drainage basin of the river itself, But then there's this whole issue of the water allocation, which is not resolved, although it's in the process of attempting to be resolved. And California basically is going to find themselves shut off from an enormous amount of the water supply. One of the very good articles that came out about this was in National Geographic in the June 91 issue. And they have some very nice photographs and a discussion of what's going on. But one of their best, so they started off by showing casinos in Las Vegas and talk about how dependent Las Vegas is upon water coming from the Colorado River. And yet, the debate is to whether they need to be using all of that water. But to those of you who are more interested in the story, there was also something in Time on the Colorado River in July as well. So, as I say, it's gotten a lot of press. Well, I know that it's getting close to this very interesting dinner setup that we're having tonight. But,
okay, to run out of water without bread.
But we are not in a region where water is a particular problem in terms of quantity. And yet, I guess one of the things that I feel very strongly is that the entire country, the entire world, needs to be programmed to simply be dependent upon less water, no matter where we live, so that when we go to some other area which may be having a problem with water quantity, then we can contribute what we can. And so what we can spend the last few minutes talking about is simply what we can do on a personal basis to impact water consumption. And one of the books which has really a great discussion of a lot of different environmental issues is this little one by Judith Geddes called You Can Make a Difference. And basically they take any one of a number of problems. They start with the land and talk about garbage and hazardous waste, and then they talk about water both in terms of quality and quantity, and talk about air issues, smog and acid rain and greenhouse and so on. And they discuss what the problem itself is and then the different kinds of things that one individually can do. And before we talk about what we individually may do around our own homes or communities, I would like to encourage all of us to remember that not only can we have that impact, but that we can impact legislation. And I think that's one of the most important things.
One of the things that they are looking at fairly seriously is finding new sources of water for California, since the Colorado is drying up.
And since their rights to the Colorado
and,
world.
And they're losing the rights to Mono Lake and everything. I mean, they want to run a pipeline from Alaska to California. Or
actually,
Oregon.
They'd like to run a pipeline from Oregon.
From Oregon.
Yeah, Oregon State.
Why don't they do Salinas? Like Saudi Arabia.
Well,
it's very, very expensive. Key West.
They've already started to build plants, though.
To do it, yeah. Key West is an example of a community which has virtually no fresh water of their own. I mean, it's a small island down far off the coast. And they receive water which is piped down the entire length of the Keys, but the water pressure down there is minuscule, and so they've been forced to go to desalinization. But this then raises the issue of the cost of water. And I maintain very strongly, but this is also a very callous attitude, that if you charged for water based on what it actually costs to get water in a region, in a community, yeah, that you would impact the size of the population there, among other things.
Yeah.
And that it's too late to do that in Los Angeles. There's already too many people there.
Except that it continues to expand.
Well, but the thing is that water is controlled usually by the municipality, and it's never sold and purchased as a free market commodity. And if it were, the cost of it would reflect how difficult it was to get in any area.
Well, they have a tax problem down there too, in terms of the municipalities won't be able to continue to shoulder that burden on the basis of taxes, because the taxpayers don't want to pay the taxes either. They're going to find out the water costs.
But it's very difficult to do that sort of after the fact, and it has to get incremented very gradually. In Los Angeles, my brother-in-law and sister-in-law lived there. I don't know if this is true where your family lives, but basically everybody was forced to take a 30% reduction in water usage this past year. But for some reason, their water consumption for a family of three was already below what the stated average was or something, so they weren't having to reduce dramatically. But I guess the way it works is that each time that you do not come below this level, you're penalized, And every time you're penalized again, that penalty increases in magnitude. So that...
My understanding is that it may have been different community to community. My understanding is there was a 20% requirement per request, but that the area actually did a larger reduction than that, and so there was really no enforcement of those penalties.
Somebody I was talking to about it was actually saying that they knew of some community where after X number of times of violation, your water actually was shut off.
Probably Santa Barbara. You can walk on their reservoir.
Right.
Now, don't the farmers, they get very cheap water in California, and if they're made to pay the price for water, then the price of food will go up too, I would expect.
But again, that comes, but that comes back to then the fact that we are dependent upon so much more water than what we see going through our hands in any given day.
California is the nation's largest agriculture.
That's right, and we are going to have to shoulder the burden for liking the fact that we have fresh lettuce in the middle of winter. I mean,
one of the things though is that it may be that because it's always been so cheap, it may be that they will need now to look at growing different things that do not require, for instance, rice, which requires flooding of the fields, and it may be that those crops are not going to be able to be grown there anymore.
And they certainly know better ways to grow the same crops without using nearly as much.
That's right, that we've been so callous because it's always been there that we've not looked at conserving.
That's right.
There was a great political cartoon in our Portland newspaper of the California farmers watering their crops with Perrier.
But this, I think, is one thing that points out how dependent we are upon water sources in other areas. And my parents lived for a year in Cambridge, England, and in the wintertime they ate one fresh vegetable, and that was Brussels sprouts, because it could be grown locally in that season of the year. And we all are very spoiled by having all sorts of fresh things which come primarily from the San Joaquin Valley. And we've gotten very used to tomatoes in the middle of winter.
We took a trip to Phoenix a couple of years ago, a convention kind of trip, and I couldn't believe what was going on there. They bring their water down in great big open canals, and you just practically see it going from this guy. And the hotel that we were sent to by my company was this huge luxury place, and the main thing about the hotel was little ponds and lakes and swimming pools all over the place, and they're evaporating.
My husband used to live in that area, and I don't know specifically where he was talking about, but there was one place, and it may have been a country club or something in Phoenix, where there was a huge water fountain. I mean, huge fountain that shot up into the air. And it was next to an Indian reservation that had no source of water.
Well, the place is famous for its golf courses.
I know. It drives me crazy to drive through deserts and see golf courses.
Well, on 2020, there was a segment about expansion of Los Angeles into the desert. People are commuting like 4 hours from their homes in the desert. And in this segment, the part, you know, what it was really about was commuting 4 hours. But the part that drove me crazy was every single one of those houses had great big green lawns. And the sprinklers were all gone. You know, and they're planting lawns in the desert.
And in fact, that's true in this area of the country as well. I was very amazed after living through a wet winter to discover that my lawn is brown in the summertime, mm-hmm. in the Puget Sound or in the Northwest in general. Mm-hmm. And yet we all want very much to have the kind of vegetation that, you know, Ozzie and Harriet had in their front yard on the TV show. And I think that is something that is going to have to be considered as to what is the natural vegetation. And in Southern California, there's been a lot of encouragement over the years to go back to something more natural. Los Angeles is not expanding into the desert. Los Angeles is just expanding its occupation of the desert. Right. I mean, the natural vegetation there is desert.
They're headed toward Death Valley.
The case in the Minnesota courts right now where a woman in the city of Edina planted her lawn to drought-resistant plant. I forgot the name of it just now, but it's not grass, and it grows about a foot high. It stops there, and it has flowers, and it's very pretty all by itself. But in amongst all of these beautiful green lawns, and she'd been taken to court. The city says she doesn't have a right to do that.
Oh, she won her case.
Did she?
Did she?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Well, she sure should.
But
I want to know what she planted, too.
It raises all kinds of things in terms of water consumption. One thing that you can do to simply require less water on your lawns is not mow it as short, because longer grass retains more moisture.
But you know, you buy a lawnmower and try to mow your lawn 4 inches high with the lawnmower
no,
that you could buy.
I'm not saying 4 inches high, but even the adjustment that you can do to the top of it.
And I do that, and it's still not as high as I'd like to go.
Right.
Yeah.
The whole thing about lawns is nutty, too. My husband is a historian, he found this whole thing about where lawns come from. They're sort of all up really middle-class people trying to pretend that we have estates in England.
Yeah.
It's really true, but we should not even be having any lawns.
Yeah.
Greatness for barbecue, though.
That's right. We need to sort of officially quit at this point, since people have other things to go, but I mean, we can stay. I sort of have to say this because they turn the microphones off at 55 minutes after I start. So. But if people have other suggestions about kinds of things that they do, you know, it's a great forum to share them, basically. I mean, we all know we should flush less and fill our toilet tanks with something other than a brick to reduce the volume of water that sits in there. Bricks will disintegrate and clog your plumbing, so please don't get a brick in there. Take an old plastic bottle and fill it with water and something like that instead.
I have an anecdote about flooding that might be comforting. In Minnesota, we had 100-year floods in 1965 and 68, if I recall correctly. And we haven't had any since.
Well, gee, that's nice.
You should tell me.
You only have another 72 years to go or something, right?
No, I think it's 172.
No.
I live on a little lake in Minnesota, and the last 3 years the surface has dropped 6 feet.
Oh.
But this year it's back to normal again.
Absolutely. Wasn't Lake Michigan doing something weird, getting higher and higher and higher and flooding Lakeshore Drive?
The houses are falling into the lake.
Once again, if you live right next to a big body of water. Anything you wanted to say?
Going back to lawns, I read the other day that watering in the hot part of the day, you lose 75% or greater of the water to evaporation.
That's right, and I'm very impressed around here to see that the watering all takes place at the end of the day and the very beginning of the day. Those are the two smartest times of day to water.
And somebody mentioned irrigation canals, and I understand that they're now covering a lot of the long haul canals to keep the efforts.
Of course, one of the purposes of some of that, like the LA aqueduct is open quite a bit, and one of the purposes of that is to aerate the water, which is a little bit easier to drain. Mm-hmm.
Right.
So yeah, there's a trade-off there.
That's a real problem. Okay.
This may be a question that's just too individual. I don't know.
Maybe.
But,
I'll try.
We have a well. It's about 100 feet deep. It goes about 40 feet below the level of a lake that's 400 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
Are we drinking lake water?
That
has altogether to do with the rock formation?
Yeah, and it's sort of what the natural... See, all groundwater is actually flowing in one direction or another.
Yeah.
Very slowly, and so you'd have to look more at what's going on, where the groundwater is actually moving.
Well,
chances are the groundwater is moving toward the lake rather than away from the lake.
Yeah, the pressure in the well brings the water up a little bit above the level of the lake in our well.
Yeah.
So that supports that theory. Yeah. And in fact, we've had it tested and it's perfect.
Yeah, it's amazing. Groundwater is much purer than surface water because the whole natural process of water flowing through the particles in the ground is a process of purification.
Yeah.
And so to use groundwater, we're lucky. We really are to have the resource.